You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom. It seems like it's been forever since I've seen you.
Robert Wright, it's a pleasure to be talking to you again.
You know, our viewers last saw you heading in the general direction of maternity ward. Paul, do you have any news?
I do. I have a beautiful daughter named Zoe, who is, as of today, 7 weeks old.
Wow.
She is starting to do social smiles.
What is that? Fake smiles? You mean fake smiles?
She is a veritable cutie.
Does that mean fake smiles? Social smiles?
No. Oh, you're such an evolutionary psychologist. No, no, sincere smiles of love.
Although, you know,
most of it, we have a big black and white painting. She devotes most of her smiles towards the painting, which she seems to really love. But then to me and my wife.
You said a couple of things that could be the result of parental cognitive bias. It started with you saying that she was attractive. Look, I'm not saying she's not. I'm just saying I've never seen a baby that age that, objectively speaking, was. Okay? Yours could be an exception, or could be you're living in a dream world, Paul.
I am with you. There's a fair amount of ugly, kind of model, pimply babies, kind of tubby in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
The baby I have is perfect, exception to the rule.
Well, congratulations on that. What were the chances?
Thank you.
That's great. That's great. Are you happy?
Me, on the other hand, I mean, some people are listening to this, but when I first came on to this, you said something to the effect of, you look tired.
No, I actually think what I said was,
somebody.
I think I said something possibly less kind. I said it looked like you hadn't been outdoors in months.
Oh.
Well, whereas I look like I just hiked the Appalachian Trail, as they say. Oh,
no, I have not been hiking the Appalachian Trail. Literally.
Well, you must have at some point, Paul, because you got a kid.
Is that a new literal meaning? Is this basically?
I think strictly speaking, it refers to an extramarital dalliance.
Yes.
So, and this is not that, because you are married.
I like
to
your
mother.
Usage. Like somebody says, "Oh, I had a wonderful date last night," and you can say, "Did you hike the Appalachian Trail?"
That is what I say.
How many times do you and your wife hike the Appalachian Trail each week?
Are you asking me? Because I'm willing to tell you.
No, I'm not. Well, I don't know. We have an open topic.
Overtime. Today. Wait, we're gonna have overtime for paid subscribers only. We'll be revealing that information.
That'll be something.
Now, Paul, I have some good news for you because this is your first daughter. You had two sons, but I've had two daughters. I have good news. 15 years from now, when the parent offspring conflict reaches some of its most intense levels, I predict that the lion's share of the conflict will be directed to the mother and not the father. Now I have no data on this. I haven't looked at scholarship, but I assume that on average, the intragender adolescent parent conflict is the stronger. Don't you think? What was your experience with your sons? Like you were their less favorite of the two parents?
It oscillated depending on the time and depending on the son, but I think there's a sense in which there was a tighter love towards their mother, particularly when they were younger. Mm-hmm. And I could see it being switched where, the cliche is, you know, the daughters in some way are adored by their fathers and adore them in turn. While the mothers, there is conflict of a sort.
Exactly. With my own experience as a son was that the conflict was probably more intense with my father than my mother. That hence my generalization about genders, but I don't know.
I will say that in the sort of a lot of the campus wars where we complain about students and helicopter parents, there is something of a cliche, which I've seen exhibited many times, of the undergraduate girl, woman, talking mm-hmm. to her mother all the time on the phone, mm-hmm. constantly texting back and forth as if they're buddies.
Well, I do think the conflict is followed by bonding. It passes. Yeah. The period of conflict passes. By the way, I should introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, world-famous psychologist and father, and already something of an expert on the development of children, especially along the moral dimension. That's where some of your work was. I'm sure your daughter, morally speaking, is beyond... whatever that the word I'm looking for is, beyond what? How does that go?
Well, on the one hand, there's original sin, but on the other, there's an innate moral sense. So they battle it out inside her.
That's one way to One way to look at it. So Zoe, is there anything interesting about the etymology of that? I'd never seen that name, I think, until I saw the either short story or novelette by J.D. Salinger called Franny and Zoe.
Franny and Zoe. Mm-hmm. That's with a Y, if I remember correctly.
Oh, so this is just Z-O-E?
Just Z-O-E.
But you and pronounce it Zoe. It's not Zoe? Yeah. Zoe?
No, Zoe. Zoe. Hmm. It's also not Z-O-E-Y, which I think is only Zoe Deschanel, the Manic Dream Pixie Girl.
Hmm. Does it mean something, though? Is there
She's a very attractive actress and very talented actress.
As I'm sure your daughter will be, except possibly
story,
not
just,
an actor.
I think we just like the sound of it.
Uh-huh. I like it. I like
I think
it.
We just like the sound of it.
So
I like. We didn't really, as you could tell right now by the crosstalk, we didn't really make a plan for this discussion. We could go, in some way, we just talk about, you know, parenting advice, there being fathers and mothers, the whole debate over whether parents matter. Still always a vibrant debate.
That is one of several topics that we could talk about that are related to kids. We could talk about,
I mean, seeing you makes me want to talk about Tucker Carlson.
Thank you.
I'm not triggers in the sort of sure that's journalistic aspect.
Paul, like, I'm not sure how to react when you say I remind you of Tucker Carlson. Like, he's a good looking guy, fine. And there are some virtues to his ideology, I suppose. But what exactly do you mean?
No, all I meant was, you know, I've been for the last 7 weeks thinking about babies and baby stuff and parenting and so on. And seeing you ignites this whole different part of me where we would talk about AI and Elon Musk, definitely
and
Donald
Carlson.
Trump. And certainly we'd be talking about Tucker Carlson,
yeah,
who has turned, as you may have heard, against Donald Trump.
Well, there's some questions of who turned first, but they sure aren't happy
Call
with
us
each
a scoop.
Other. They sure aren't happy with each other. Gosh, I wish I had queued up that True Social of Trump's where he went off on all the MAGA opponents of the war. That was a thing of beauty.
It was a thing of beauty. Apparently, Tucker Carlson is low intelligence.
Yeah, well, and his family knows it. I think, didn't Trump say that? He said they're all low IQ and their family knows it or something. It was let's do a quick Trump psychology session. I asked a guest this recently. Is he just what you would expect from the 79-year-old version of the first-term Trump, or are we in a whole nother world?
I think this is pure Trump. I think this is Trump talks in my first introduction that Trump was an unusual candidate was way, way early in the process, where he was doing some sort of interview, and he was asked a free association game where he's going to say something, he has to say what he thinks about it. And the person says George Bush, who was by then a Republican president. And Trump said, low IQ.
Yeah.
Which cracked me up. I mean, it's fellow Republican and everything. So Trump is obsessed with IQ. He loves to talk in a language of shame. The Supreme Court justices who voted against him should be ashamed. Their families are ashamed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the whole insult comic routine became a fixture, but he's I don't know, he's definitely a little more off kilter this time around, and unfortunately he's orchestrating more major wars in the process.
Yes. He seems to have discovered a sort of love of war. If only they had given him the Peace Prize, maybe he would have behaved differently.
I'm just hoping he wants to get out of this one with a Peace Prize. Maybe that's our only hope, but yeah. Didn't work out. He got the FIFA. He got the FIFA Peace Prize. You saw that, right?
My sons would play the FIFA video game, and
many have sought that prize. Few have been so honored.
I got to say, by the way, Tucker Carlson is not low IQ.
Tucker Carlson is
extremely smart, a wonderfully adept speaker, very sharp. I think somewhat unhinged, but. Again, I've said this before here. It would not surprise me to find him a Republican candidate for president at some point.
People have speculated as much. I don't think he'd win, but I do think that if he and Marjorie Taylor Greene ran as a third party ticket, that would teach a lesson that they would like to teach to MAGA, which is to say Republicans can't win an election without the anti-war coalition on board. This time we defected, and as a result, the Democrats won. I mean, it's within their power to do that. That's real power,
right?
That's
a wonderful Democratic fantasy. I'm very happy. You know, that would be
wonderful. You know, I hope he thinks of that. But wouldn't it be great to have that much influence? Like, Paul, if you and I could just say, you know, if we run as a ticket, leaving aside who would be at the top, we can talk about that in overtime. If we run as a ticket, that will take out the Democrats. If we had that kind of influence, that would be great.
Who would we steal votes from, I wonder?
Well, that's
Trump,
the problem.
Harris.
That's what I'm saying. Nobody, because we don't have any influence, Paul. Oh, you mean if we did?
Yeah, I think we have complicated bipartisan influence. I think we'd get both Republicans and Democrats in equal measure.
Yeah, we would be, no labels. We would take the no labels vote away, which doesn't exist. A fact that was discovered by the no labels people who tried to turn that into a thing. I think that was a Bloomberg thing, right? No labels.
Who is the guy? I'm Andrew. There was some guy who was going running as sort of a third party that was meant to be nonpartisan, ideological.
Beats me, but Andrew's a good start. It's a very inoffensive name.
It was definitely an Andrew.
Yeah.
And I remember him having his first interview, and he was asked something like, so what does your party say about abortion? And he said, well, you know, and he actually had absolutely no answer to that.
Yeah.
Which kind of, sometimes you do have to have a view on something.
You do. That was a problem with no labels. It's like, there have to be labels.
I think, yeah,
you need some labels. In this crazy world of ours. So, yeah. So really, though, how is it? I mean, is this a whole new... You wrote a piece for your Substack, Small Potatoes, about how this time parenthood was different, Paul.
Yes. It is different in a few ways. It is, I am older. Mm-hmm. My boys that was about 30 years ago when I had my two sons. I am older.
Mm-hmm.
And this has sort of strengths and weaknesses. I think the sleep deprivation is in some sense harder on me now.
And yet you mind it less. Did you not say that in your Small Potatoes post? Didn't you say that?
Sorry, you faded out there.
Oh, I think you said in your Small Potatoes post that the sleeplessness bothers you less. Well, maybe you didn't say less than the first time around, but you said less than usual. Because, right. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I thought then you could dispute it.
Right.
I've long battled with insomnia. We've talked about this here, but long battle with insomnia.
We all do.
And part of it that comes with insomnia is like, I don't know, it's a shame that comes with it. Like, you know, I ruined my whole day. But because my bad night's sleep is because I'm keeping alive a small and helpless creature, I'm groggy the next day, but I feel good about myself. It doesn't bother me as much.
Yeah.
I'll also say, at a career stage, with the exception of our conversations, you know, I feel comfortable moving away from work to some extent during this period. I don't feel like, you know, oh my God, I'm missing so much. I do miss our conversations. But besides that, you know, that's another advantage this stage of my life.
So do I have the honor of being the first thing that has lured you away from your parental duty since your child was born, 7 weeks ago?
You are probably the first thing I don't have to do. Like I have, I just came back from TED in Vancouver.
Oh, could we hold off on the bragging just a little while? You just bragged about your kid.
I know. We've been talking for like 10 minutes. I've held off.
Well, yeah, bragging about your kid. You don't get a medal for that.
I'm tired of bragging about my kid. I want to brag about myself.
Okay. Paul.
No,
was,
I'll tell you. Later.
And when is your child going to deliver her TED talk, Paul? Do you have that lined up?
When I came there, very nice there, and it gave me a gift. The people who organized it gave me a gift, and it's a little onesie that says "Future TED Speaker."
Oh my God! Are you kidding? I called that one.
You did. You did.
Now, did you bond with Chris Anderson personally, who's a close personal friend of mine?
Chris Anderson and I. Yes, we hung out. We talked.
Mm-hmm.
I've
he
known
probably
him
mentioned
from
me. Did he mention me?
Nonstop.
Uh huh. Good.
Okay, so we've talked because this is his last TED that he's running.
I know. He told me in an email. I know these things.
Oh, okay. This is just a setup for you to tell me that.
No, it's actually true. It's actually true. But the downside is it was his excuse for not being available for lunch when I was going to be in New York. He was in Vancouver at his last TED conference. Yep. So he claimed, and I'm glad to hear you validate that.
No, he was there. He was there. Yep. He said, yep. You know, this is a great conference, but I'm sad to be missing lunch with Bob.
Yeah, well.
Can I tell you my TED story?
If that's it, yeah, you can repeat that one.
I'm getting mic'd up for my talk. I'm extremely nervous. And this guy who came, I won't say his name, but a guy came up to me, and he's an older man. He'd given a wonderful talk himself. Mm-hmm. So he comes up to me and he introduced himself. And he said, I really liked your talk. And he said, I admire you so much. Now, sometimes people say, oh, I like your, you know, whatever, I read something, but it was really something. And I said, oh, thank you. He said, you are a hero to me, he says. And I say, oh, thank you. I've never had people say that to me. And I'm confused. And he leans over to me and he whispers in my ear, you should have been president.
Did he think you were Alan Bloom?
No, he thought it was Al Gore.
You know, you look a little like Al Gore.
I do.
That's
and
weird.
Al Gore was also at TED.
Al Gore was at TED the time I talked to TED.
I am well aware of that. And he said, you guys bonded.
Wait, I said that or he said that? I said that.
you said, because
true. There's a lot happened with me and Al Gore at that TED thing. But one thing that happened, look, I don't want to steal your thunder. Tell us about your fucking TED talk, Paul. Go ahead. And then I'll tell my anecdotes in overtime, because really, frankly, they are worth, I'm not going to say they're worth more money than your anecdotes, but let's just say no less. Go ahead. Deliver your free anecdotes.
It was self-deprecating. Because, you know, it's not about me. He was so excited, but he thought I was somebody else.
That's so funny. It's funny. You had been claiming you look like Robert Redford, which with all due respect, Paul.
My wife says I look like Robert Redford.
Well, I just got to say that you married the right woman. I'm not sure how easy it would have been to find another one who shares that view. But you do look like Al Gore. You do.
I do look a little bit like Al Gore.
It's eerie.
Now, once you see it, you can't not. And this is the second time it's happening. Once at an airport, a slightly inebriated man came up to me and was very, thought I was Al Gore.
Said Al.
Did I dissuade them because I didn't. It seems rude.
Yeah, no, I say no. Well, give them their moment of thinking that they're talking to a former vice president. You know what you should do is talk shit about Bill Clinton whenever anybody does that.
Do you know who else was at the TED conference? Monica Lewinsky, who I did not meet.
You know, oh man, I'm sorry, I can't resist this. You know where I saw Monica Lewinsky?
Go ahead.
In Chris Anderson's apartment. Beat that. Oh. Beat that.
I can't beat that.
You can't
beat
that. She was at a party. I didn't have the nerve. I didn't know, like, how do you... I'm bad at approaching people. You know who else I saw there and did not have the courage to approach is it Meg Blake?
Jeffrey Epstein.
Jeff, no. Well, but as you know, Jeff and I are, you know.
I've seen the emails.
Anyway, Meg Ryan, I mean. Who's Meg Blake?
Meg Ryan?
And I didn't have the courage. Like, it's so easy to say I'm your biggest fan. Which in that case is not that far from being true. I just wilt in the presence of greatness. I have to drink a lot of coffee just to work up the courage to talk to you.
You do well. You hide your anxiety.
My insecurity. Yeah. My saddest anxiety I try to keep pokes. Concealed when I'm talking to you.
That's right. That's right. I am no Meg Ryan, I got to say.
Yeah. Anyway, enough name dropping. What were we talking about and why? Oh,
let's see. That was basically my
what was your talk about? What was your talk about?
My talk was about AI and loneliness.
Oh shit! Wait, I'm the one coming out with an AI book, which people could pre-order if they want. It's called The God Test. Never too soon to pre-order. I didn't mean to upstage you. What was your talk about?
Look. My talk was before I was on a panel that my friend Dan Gilbert put together. And it was a very good panel. It had Nick Epley was there, Eli Finkel, and Ann Patchett was there, the novelist. And Ann, who gave a wonderful talk, began her talk by saying, I'll tell you something, I'm not going to talk about AI. And the whole audience applauded because every other fucking talk was about AI. And then
that's bad news for me.
About AI.
That's bad news for me, isn't it?
Well, everybody's talking about it because, you know, you'll just be...
It's big.
Believe it or not, it seems to be a topic du jour.
It's big. Last time I got anything like a round of applause like that, I brought my laptop up. I was giving a talk, not unrelated to AI, although this was about 20 years ago, and I said, don't worry, I'm not going to use PowerPoint. I got a wild ovation for not using PowerPoint.
Must have been a while ago.
Well, it was. But it was still a fresh thing to say back then. It was before, yeah. So,
when is AI coming out?
In June, so it's really not too soon to pre-order. And pre-ordering helps, and it gets the attention of the publishing house, and they print more copies, and you get invited to the next year's TED conference, if everything goes well. Back to you, which brings us back to you. So was this based on your New Yorker piece? Are you kind of like double dipping here? I mean, you write one piece and then you get all these talks out of it. So you still have time to be a father.
Yes. It's self-plagiarism at a high level.
Mm-hmm.
But what, you're going to give a talk. You're going to give talks based on your book.
I don't know. I'm not.
I mean, if you get a chance.
I'm not besieged with demands. I am going to be a politics and prose in DC. We know that already. But Paul,
Your books have all been bangers. I'm very confident that God Test will do well.
I'll bet you say that to all the guys.
Your last one was the Buddhism book?
Yeah.
That was good.
Good. You said it was a banger.
I'm a bit tainted because honestly, I was reading Substack and I just followed it and I came across something arguing against your book. I'm sure you've seen this before.
Oh, fuck that. Who is that? What's his name?
It's not, I don't remember his name. It just argued that it was, you know, argued that the scientific evidence for Buddhism is lame. I'm not defending the view.
Mine isn't even controversy. They probably hadn't even read it. I mean, that's not even my shtick in that book. I'm not like trotting out all. In fact, I say I'm not getting into the evidence on meditation. You know, it's not, they didn't read the book. Who is this scoundrel?
I will find them. You can just fuck them up.
I will find the culprit and bring him to justice.
But anyway, your book's coming out June. June is soon.
Yeah, I know. It's late June.
How come they never received a copy?
I can probably arrange it. Well, the copies themselves don't exist. There are bound galleys. But
I hear you can send things over email these days.
Some things? PDFs? You want a PDF?
I'll take a PDF. Do you have anything Kindle ready?
I don't think I do. But enough about me.
I just want to search for my name.
I have bad news for you, Paul.
not my views have been shaped and developed through years of conversation with.
The good news is that the word Paul is in there.
Oh.
Lowercase bloom, maybe. But tell us about your talk. So what is remind us of your loneliness thesis.
My talk is admirably complex and subtle, which is that, and in fact, it's, I think the talk went well. If I had to be self-critical, I would say it isn't the sort of powerful claim that garners hundreds of millions of views. I just basically said, look, if AI could alleviate loneliness, on the one hand, it'd be wonderful. And a lot of people would really benefit. I talked about elderly people a lot. On the other hand, it would have certain severe social costs as people became addicted to this AI, this loneliness relieving AI, lost the opportunity to interact with people and also lost the opportunity to grow as a person through interacting with people who challenge you and get bored and aren't always there when you need them and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's a mixed bag, this AI.
That's too complicated for if you're looking for a standing ovation. That's just a little too complicated, Paul.
I got a semi-standing ovation.
What does that mean? Half of the people stood.
It's not all or nothing. Some people stood.
Really? What got them out of their seats? I mean, I'm not saying what you've said so far isn't, you know, like super inspiring, but what do you think got them out of their seats?
I will tell you, it was a generous crowd, and most people got some sort of standing ovation.
Really? Oh,
yes.
That's the whole point of holding it in Canada, I guess, huh?
No,
There was, it's like everybody honestly, goes, that was great.
Honestly, there's one exception. I don't want to call somebody because I really enjoyed this talk, but it was somebody talking about using IVF as a way to select babies, select embryos. Mm-hmm. And that everybody should use IVF. We should no longer procreate the old-fashioned way.
So this was a eugenics, a pitch for eugenics, basically?
Well, the fact that you could describe it as such is maybe one reason why there was not a standing
they
ovation.
They did not get a standing ovation. You know, Paul, not to toot my own horn, but like decades ago, I wrote a cover story for the New Republic. Decades ago, God, three, more than, I don't know, however many, like four, almost four. This is crazy. And I made the observation. It was the cover story on James Watson that I've mentioned to you, which led him to never say anything nice about me again. But I made the observation that in the past, eugenics had always been something that could not happen in the absence of centralized authority. And in the future, it will be something that can only be stopped by centralized authority, because you can do it at the, with homemade eugenics. And this was a call for homemade eugenics, right?
Yeah. But you know something, if you want to use the term eugenics to describe the selection of embryos, well, first thing, we already do it. So if you go for IVF and you have a bunch of embryos and one of them has the evidence for Down syndrome, mm-hmm. you're probably not going to choose to implant that one.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is if you want to call it eugenics, fine, then eugenics is a mm-hmm. good thing. You know, we do this all the time to screen out for severe neurological disorders, cases where kids, you know, will die as soon as they're born. You know, and again, there are people who say, well, that's eugenics. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, then eugenics isn't necessarily bad. I find I have mixed feelings about selecting for embryos that lack, say, evidence for becoming schizophrenic or bipolar or breast cancer. But I tend to think if you're going to do IVF, you wouldn't want to select out those things.
So in
I guess there are two questions for you. Do you agree that that's a good thing? And then the second one, would you call it eugenics?
Let me get a little clearer than I... Well, one point I made in the piece is distinguishing between preventing bad things and selecting for good things is pretty blurry. Right.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
For example, there are certain things you can define as a malady or not, like attention deficit disorder. You know, it's like, you know, whatever. And also, like, suppose you could select for IQ. And by the way, you know, Elon Musk, I believe, has availed himself of the services of a company that is said to test for, they claim they're testing for intellectual potential in the...
I could be mistaken, but I think the person who spoke was the CEO of that company.
Mm-hmm. So this was... well, if so, I mean, did they talk about that? Did this person embrace that kind of eugenics where you want a higher than average IQ in your kid and you select and you... So you weed out the three embryos, the three lowest IQ embryos or whatever?
Yeah.
And they were in favor of that.
And as am I.
So to summarize, you resonated to the Nazi TED talk is another way to put it. Is that
that's right. That's right.
Yes.
That's right. It was mm-hmm. The only talk,
you know,
by the way.
You know who else you look like besides that? You got a little bit of an Aryan vibe there, you know? Now that I look at it.
Whoa. Whoa. You're dealing with your status anxiety. I think you're overcompensating a bit.
Bloom is an Aryan name, is it not?
No, it's not.
No,
it is German. I think the BLUM spelling is German.
Yeah. So
anyway, so
well, look,
but no. Well,
I have issues. I have issues.
I'm aware my view is controversial,
mm-hmm.
but I don't. If I was doing IVF and I thought that these procedures worked, and I think a lot of it's bullshit. I think there's a lot of stuff we just do not really fully understand. Can't predict the way people say we can predict. But suppose we can. I would then try to select an embryo, which gave me the best odds of having a kid who wouldn't have breast cancer, who wouldn't become schizophrenic, who would be healthy,
mm-hmm.
and who would be smart.
Okay, but those are kinds of, as I said, it's a fuzzy line between preventing pathologies and selecting four strong attributes that are way above average. And it seems to me in that case, the line is actually pretty clear. Like, right? I mean, breast cancer is clear pathology, malady. That's not a subjective call. Schizophrenia, by and large, we're talking about extreme bipolar or whatever form of, but you know, if you're think smarter than their average high school peer, that's a different kettle of fish, and it's not that hard to draw that distinction. What I would say is, if this is going to be a thing and is going to be available and legal, then I think the government should make it financially available to all parents. It seems to me,
I think that's a great idea.
Seems that we do not need.
To be sure, the CEO said the same thing.
Well, of course. He's in the business, though. I'm doing it out of actual See, that was bias.
I know. But you see, I don't call you on that. That's fine.
Mm. No, I know. That's what I like about you.
I mean, one thing to think about is one of the talks that did get a standing ovation, deservedly so, was a guy who was devoting his, and I will ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to remember this, but the question is something like, what kills more people than all wars? Not as much as cancer, but more than all the wars.
I don't know. It's a trick question, right? So it's probably going to be like bowling accidents.
It's not that much of a trick question, uh-huh. but it's a lead.
Mm.
So lead just has, and you know, I double checked it. And lead just kills a lot of people, and it's very preventable. But so here's how I frame it. And that talk got a standing ovation. Here's how I frame it. If I said to you, you know, I'm going to prevent children in this area from getting lead poisoning, which will then make their IQ, make them mm-hmm. smarter. Because mm-hmm. one of the things is this leads to sort of reduction in intellectual capacity. Nobody says, you asshole, how can you know you're Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
They say, yeah, of course you want to do that. What a wonderful person you are. Does it make a difference if you do it before they're born?
Keep them from being killed by lead poisoning?
No, if I said I have steps to make children on average smarter, people would say.
Oh, I see. You're saying
that's a good thing.
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, it reminds me of education, as you're suggesting. It has some things in common with the education that takes place after birth, and one of them, in my mind, is I think we should do a better job of making educational resources available to low-income people, and I would say the same thing about the prenatal interventions on behalf of. But one thing I'd say about intelligence.
I agree with that, but maybe you're more socialist than I am on this, which is if you were to say you can afford to give your daughters smaller class sizes when they're kids, and suppose it turned out that meant they'd be smarter as adults and better adjusted and better educated, I first think, wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody else could do that too? But I don't necessarily think, well, unless everybody could get that, we should take it away from you.
Well, as a practical matter, that's just pretty hard to do. Yeah. You know, some things are easier than others. And just, you know, subsidizing certain medical interventions is not that complicated. I mean, it's maybe expensive, but it's not. You know, it's not as hard to do. Anyway, the one thing I was going to say was I would distinguish between things that just make a person's life absolutely better, like being alive as opposed to dying of breast cancer
mm-hmm.
or having, you know, a fairly stable mental life as opposed to being schizophrenic. I would distinguish that from intelligence in the sense that one of the main actual practical uses of intelligence is just in status competition. And that's a zero-sum game. It's a positional good. You're not making, by handing out weapons to use in status competition, you're not making society as a whole better off. Because
I agree with that for some things, like height. I think if you make your kid, your male, usually your son, 6'8".
Yeah.
The only reason to do that is give an advantage over 6'6" kids who will then have to make their own kid 6'8" and so on.
Right.
I think intelligence is also an absolute good, though. I think the world would benefit from smarter people.
I don't. I really don't. Well, when I look around and see what the problems are with the world, like let's take war, it's not an intelligence problem. It's not. If you look at the psychological causes of war, it's about cognitive biases. It's about clear vision. It's about tribal allegiance. These are not issues of intelligence. And in fact, one thing it's about is intelligent people manipulating the psychology of the masses to their own ends and arranging it so that the sons of low-income people go off and die in the fucking wars in ways that elevate the status of the politicians who benefit from the wartime mentality. So I really differ with you there. Now,
well, but I'm not arguing that. I'm not saying that if you raise people's intelligence, war would go away. It'd be a paradise.
Well, what good thing would happen?
I do think that there's a correlation.
Yeah,
I think you'd be better off if your neighbors and your neighbors' kids were extremely smart than if they were really not smart at all.
In what way?
One thing is smart people are able to engage and understand long-term non-zero-sum interactions. So it's not an accident, for instance, that, you know, very low intelligence is often correlator of crime.
Well, now that I...
And it's not to say that smart people can't commit crimes, but...
But wait, are we controlling for our variables here? I mean, IQ is correlated with income level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, partly for reasons I'm saying is that intelligence helps you in the form of status competition we refer to as economic competition. Low-income people, not surprisingly, are in all societies more likely to commit crimes. That might account for what I've just described, might account for a correlation between intelligence and crime, an inverse correlation, without it reflecting a kind of direct causal relation, without it reflecting intelligent people being able to weigh the consequences of crime and all that shit, right? Like... Have you controlled your variables here?
I think some of the studies have controlled their variables. And these
Seems like it's going to be hard.
It is always hard. But look, intelligence, being smart, is an absolute good. You certainly see this at the extremes. You know, when somebody gets dementia or severe frontal lobe damage.
Well, that is the extremes, sort of, though. Preventing mental retardation. I'm not arguing against that kind of, you know, embryonic intervention.
But that's the sort of framing thing you talked about before. I mean, you can't say, oh, you can only say it's bad to be dumb, not that it's good to be smart. It's smartness is just the absence of dumb.
No, that's not true. Beyond a certain level, you're not capable of taking care of yourself, and so on. And that's just different. I mean,
I think there are diminishing returns. I would agree with that. The difference between 70 IQ and 100 IQ is different than between 100 and 130.
You know, I just don't see a correlation between how smart people are and like how much I would trust them or how much good I think they do other people in the course of their day-to-day interactions.
Looking within a society.
Well,
IQ
sure, but the correlation, yeah, but I guess I'm saying I don't see a causal correlation. I mean, sure, if lower intelligence people are lower income and that puts them in a certain environment that leads to certain things, that's one thing. But again, it's not clear that, you know, I mean, economic competition is kind of a positional thing.
I agree with you that high intelligence is definitely a positional good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like powerful theory of mind is a positional good, just like emotional regulation is a positional good. All sorts of things that could give you an advantage over someone who doesn't have it. But like these other things, I would want to be friends with and want to have myself, say, the ability to regulate my emotions, a powerful theory of mind, a powerful analytic skills, self-control. And all of these things, not just because it helps me jockey up, but because in an absolute sense, it lets you do science better, lets you write better, lets you deal with dilemmas better, focus on people better. I mean, you've championed a power of theory of mind.
Of cognitive empathy, yeah.
cognitive empathy.
Which doesn't require a whole lot of intelligence.
I think to have extremely powerful cognitive empathy, it probably taps in the same reservoir as intelligence does.
I would say beyond a certain pretty low level. I mean, one common feature of being on the spectrum is to have relatively low cognitive empathy, yep. low theory of mind. Yep. And these are some of the smartest people in the world. Silicon Valley is full of people who are on the spectrum and are very smart and are making a lot of money. And by the way, I think in my experience, the ones I've met are great people. It's a documented fact that, people on the spectrum are more likely to have low theory of mind. In yep. other words, cognitive empathy.
Yep, these things are dissociable.
Well, they're in principle dissociable, but we should continue this argument in overtime. I will say to close this out, if you ask me, who are the 10 most dangerous people in the world? They're all very smart, except for Trump.
Yes.
Okay. Like the people that I consider true perils to the world. I don't want to overdo it, but people that I worry about, a number of them are billionaires. And, so on.
But I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Look, I think it's good to be intelligent. So if I could say, if somebody said, look, here's something you do with your kids to make them smarter, you know, mm-hmm. take away the lead from their environment or put them in better classes or whatever, I would do it, not just because I want them to have a leg up in their world, but I can think this is a really good thing. But I agree that the power that intelligence enables you to wield, for the most part, you can't do a lot of damage unless you're quite smart. I'm not sure. I think Trump is above average intelligence, probably below average for an American president. But I also think he has some extraordinary gifts. We've talked about this.
We have talked about this. I'm having more and more trouble finding them, but we should go into.
He's a little bit of losing a step. Either he's losing a step with age, or maybe his shtick is finally running a little bit, you know, becoming a bit less effective.
I think he's fucking finally. Nuts. But but we can talk about this in overtime, where we should head. You can watch the overtime segment by being a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero newsletter or the Small Potatoes newsletter, right? And by the way, if you are a paid subscriber to either, you can get a 50% discount on a subscription to the other. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's true.
And I know on Non-Zero, if you go to the homepage and look for the coupon, you'll catch wind of that fact. And I'm sure Paul will find a way to make it available on his own.
He's not smart enough to be able to coordinate this.
That's what I'm for, Paul. That's what I'm for, to help you, you know, to just kind of reach a little helping hand, extend a helping hand. And so what else? Oh, in overtime, I am going to tell my Al Gore TED Talk stories. What else did we... Did we vow to do anything else? Maybe
we never talked about parenting very much. We'll just do a little bit of it.
We'll do a little of that.
So were you an active parent when your children themselves were babies and toddlers?
I'm not going to give that information away for free, Paul. We're heading into overtime
okay.
right now.